You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 124, Ezekiel chapter 17. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, guess what? We play each other this week in fantasy.
That's true. You have my sympathy.
You got an early lead on me, so enjoy it while you can.
Yeah, I need a win. I'll be honest with everybody. I need the win.
Yeah, I'm sitting at the top of the league, so it's okay if I might throw you a win here or there. We'll see.
Right.
We'll see. But
all I got to do is make the playoffs. There you go. It's the whole second season.
Long way to go. So,
yeah. I still have more guys to wind up on injured reserve, between now and then. So,
what does that mean if you don't make the playoffs in your own league? How sad is that?
It is sad, and it's happened before. So I've been there before. I'll know how to cope. And there's really no way to change the settings, to make that not happen.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right, Mike. Well, chapter 16, I think, was a big success. Got a lot of good responses from that. So,
oh, good.
We've got, we're not even halfway yet, are we? We've still got a long way to go.
Got a long way to go. It's 48 chapters. You know, that I think maybe when we get to 40 to 48, the whole temple vision thing, maybe we'll lump those together. So, but who knows? I mean, that's at the end. Yeah, I don't know. If that's true, then we might be, approaching halfway. But if it's not, no, we're not there yet.
All righty, Mike. Well, Ezekiel chapter 17. I'm ready.
All right. Well, let's jump in. And it is just chapter 17. I remember at the end of the last episode, we weren't sure if it was going to be 17 and 18. Again, now that I've sort of been through it and taken a good look at it, it's going to be just chapter 17. 18 is pretty long in and of itself. And there's something in this chapter that I'm going to tack on at the end that, kind of drilling down at one particular point of something in this chapter that I think people will find interesting. And again, it's divine counsel related stuff. So in view of that, we're just going to be good to tackle chapter 17. Now, on the surface, this is a pretty transparent chapter if you're sort of acquainted with the tail end of Israelite history, right? As Nebuchadnezzar comes into town and invades Jerusalem, destroys the temple, all that. If you're familiar with that history, then this parable, and that's what it is, Ezekiel 17 is a parable of two eagles. This parable will make sense in light of the way the Bible describes those events as Jerusalem falls, and really the events like right before it, when the puppet king of Judah, Zedekiah, is trying to get some help from the Egyptians against Nebuchadnezzar and all that. If you're familiar with that, then this is pretty straightforward, at least from our perspective. I mean, if you're the person originally hearing it, and of course these things haven't happened yet, if you're an exile in Babylon, you don't really know what's happening in Jerusalem, you don't have a frame of reference for it, that's a different story. So when Ezekiel does give this parable, there's a lot of mystery to it. For the people who are hearing it, but for us looking at things in hindsight, it's a lot clearer. And there are going to be parts of this chapter that actually parallel other parts of the Hebrew Bible that make, again, the reading of this riddle, this parable, pretty clear. But there's something in it, again, toward the end that I want to drill down on that I think will be not quite as apparent. And actually, for those who are, sort of want to track on divine counsel stuff as we go through whatever portion it is we're doing, any given episode of the podcast that you'll appreciate and find pretty interesting. So I want to open here with a short quote from Taylor's Tyndale Old Testament commentary about chapter 17, and then another set of comments from Block to sort of set up what this is. And I'm going to do that first and then read, we'll start reading through the chapter and you'll begin to see how things fit together. So Taylor writes, "The theme of this chapter is the treachery of Zedekiah, the puppet king appointed by Nebuchadnezzar to replace the captive Jehoiakim. It was as a result of this treachery that Nebuchadnezzar eventually marched on Jerusalem to besiege and destroy it in 587 BC. But as this is foretold by Ezekiel in verse 20, that it is clear that the utterance of this parable is to be dated, the actual parable itself is to be dated a year or two before then, say around 590 BC. This accords well with the position of this oracle in the book, because the last preceding date, which was Ezekiel 8, verse 1, was 592 BC, and the following date, the next one we'll get in the book, which is going to be in chapter 20, is 11 months later. So this is that's the end of the quotation. This is a pretty datable passage, again, because of the historical setting, and the chapter itself is going to tell us what the parable is about. So this isn't guesswork about Zedekiah. It's something that, again, is pretty transparent, read against the backdrop, especially in hindsight, of what's going on in Jerusalem. To provoke the last phase of the captivity there in 587, 586 BC, when Nebuchadnezzar returns from Babylon to destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple. If you have that in your head, what's said here is going to be pretty clear. Now, the chapter itself divides into three sections. We're going to get the parable in the first 10 verses, then its meaning in verses 11 to 21. And then, again, Ezekiel's not going to leave everybody completely discouraged. We're going to get three verses of, you know, sort of, hey, better times are coming, you know, that sort of thing. And we've seen Ezekiel do that before, not entirely closing the door on the people of God and talking about a remnant and so on and so forth. So that's going to be familiar. Now, Block, when he tries to set this up in his own more detailed commentary, I'm just going to read you a few things that he observes about it. He has similar things to say, but the level of detail is a bit different. So Block says that the first verse, 17:1, marks the beginning of a new oracle that carries on to the end of the chapter, where it concludes with an expanded version, you know, of, again, the same formulaic language. The intervening material bears striking resemblances in vocabulary and how the chapter is structured to Ezekiel 12, verses 1 to 16. And that was where Judah's captivity was symbolized by Ezekiel packing baggage as though he were in exile, packing baggage for captivity. Block continues, the fable may be decoded in the light of the events that it purports to interpret. Based on its historical reference, the story could be retold as follows. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, who's going to be the first eagle in the parable, came to Jerusalem, or Judah, and that's going to be Lebanon in the parable, and removed its king, Jehoiakim, which in the parable is the crown of the cedars of Lebanon, and took him to Babylon, who is the merchant city in the parable. Meanwhile, he installed another member of the royal family, Zedekiah, who Block says, and again, this isn't just Block, this is, you know, every Old Testament scholar, basically. Zedekiah is labeled by the phrase in the parable, the seed of the land. In other words, some descendant from the land is going to be put on the throne with the intention that this king should remain submissive. And in the parable, he's referred to as the low vine and loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. So pick somebody that's submissive and loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. And we're going to see how the parable points to that as well. Block, again, still with him. Instead, Zedekiah redirected his allegiance to Egypt, who is the second eagle in the parable. Still a great eagle, but less impressive than the first, who is Nebuchadnezzar, thereby frustrating all the Babylonian king's aims. And consequently, now this is me talking, this is what made Nebuchadnezzar mad. Back to Block. While this approach renders the tale understandable for the modern reader, it raises questions about its significance for the original audience. The story may also be treated as a genuine riddle, whose meaning is unlocked in the interpretation in verses 11 to 12. So, right, just stop there. Again, what Block is saying is, again, the ease with which this is parsed really depends on what audience we're talking about. Is it an audience after the fact, or is it the audience that was living in the immediate time period? And again, you know, removed from the circumstances because they were in exile. Now, he writes here, this oracle about eagles, a cedar, a vine, and an east wind has employed traditional ancient Near Eastern images to construct a verbal caricature of Judah's kings. However, there's still a profound ambiguity of the fable, again, for the audience, the original audience. The prophet's intended meaning is not immediately obvious, to the original audience or reader. On the other hand, at the individual level, the vine might have symbolized any person who is destined for a full life who commits suicide or by cutting off his or her own roots. And so that what he's saying here, I'll just interject. Block is saying, well, you know, somebody who heard this, they might have thought of themselves. They might have thought of anybody, you know, when they heard the terms of this. But those of us who, again, are looking at it in hindsight, we can pretty much tell what's going on here. Now, let's jump into chapter 17, and I think you'll see again how this begins to sort of fit together. The first 10 verses is the parable, and I'm going to be interjecting what things mean. And then verses 11 to 21, the text will actually sort of verify or validate what, you know, I've said the elements of the parable mean. So we'll get a little bit of ahead of ourselves as far as identifying things, but then verses 11 to 21, again, we'll say, you know, you'll know where we're getting this. So in verse 1, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, propound a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel. Now, the terms there, riddle is kiddah. This is the same term that you'll see like in Judges 14 with Samson's famous riddle there with, you know, the man, the Philistine man and his, you know, his wife or his would-be wife at the time. So it's an enigmatic or mysterious saying. Okay, that's what a kiddah was. It's also called a parable. Again, a parable is sort of the kind of, you know, that kind of thing. Again, telling a story. Some scholars would call it an allegory, but telling a story, the elements of which, again, have some sort of greater conceptual meaning, points to something more abstract. Ezekiel himself, later in the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 20, verse 49, is going to be called a maker of parables. Block translates it as a spinner of riddles. What basically that means is Ezekiel had the reputation for telling parables and riddles and this kind of stuff. Again, it was part of his, you know, his prophetic, I guess, routine, again, if you want to call that. But he's not an entertainer, obviously. Most of what he says is just horrible to the listener. But again, he's also sort of in part a theater of the bizarre, you know, the one actor theater of the bizarre. And so he in this chapter, he's done it a little bit previously, and he'll do it some more. Again, used to communicating, and people are, you know, sort of accustomed that, well, here we go again, you know, he's telling us another story, and what does it really mean? Again, this is going to be something in Ezekiel that we see more than once, more than here. He's going to get that reputation. Verse 3. So God says to Ezekiel, say, thus says the Lord God, a great eagle with great wings and long pinions, rich in plumage of many colors, came to Lebanon and took the top of the cedar. He broke off the topmost of its young twigs and carried it to a land of trade and set it in a city of merchants. Now, again, the meaning of this is we're going to see in a little bit. And again, viewed against verses 11 through 21, and also viewed in hindsight on what actually happens to Jerusalem. This is going to be clear, but for our purposes here, the point of these two verses, verses 3 and 4, is that Nebuchadnezzar is going to be the great eagle, and he comes with great military power to Judah, and he snatches away its rulership, its nobility, its king. The top of the cedar in verse 3, and takes him to Babylon. Okay, so again, reading it after the fact, you're gonna sort of know. Okay, here, this guy was this great eagle, and snatching off the top, you know, of you know, the tree, the branch, the cedar, and taking him back, you know, to the city of merchants. Well, obviously that's Babylon. Again, that the pieces are going to start to fit. So here in verses 3 to 4, the parable is about Nebuchadnezzar coming and snatching away the leadership. Okay, of Jerusalem and taken them back to Babylon. Verse 5, then he took of the seed of the land and planted it in fertile soil. He placed it beside abundant waters. He set it like a willow twig, and it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine. And its branches turned toward him, that is, toward the eagle, and its roots remained where it stood. So it became a vine and produced branches and put out boughs. That's verses 5 and 6. So the seed of the land, as we're going to find out in a moment, is, again, corresponds to a member of the royal family. most likely. Again, Jehoiakim's uncle, Zedekiah, according to 2 Kings 24:17, Zedekiah is the one that Nebuchadnezzar installs after, again, the second wave of the exile. Zedekiah gets installed to be the puppet ruler, and that's going to work for a while, but then Zedekiah makes some very poor decisions that provoke Nebuchadnezzar to coming back and finishing the job, finishing the city, destroying the temple, the whole bit. So Nebuchadnezzar removes, again, the ruler, Jehoiakim, the top of the cedar, takes him back, you know, to Babylon, and in his place he installs Zedekiah, a member of the royal family. So he's from the seed of the land. He's an Israelite, okay? He's in a position to be a governing official and know what he's doing, but Nebuchadnezzar picks one, you know, of the ruling family and says, okay, you're in charge now. You better listen to me or I'll be back. Again, we know this story from the book of Kings, for example, the books of Kings, specifically 2 Kings and whatnot. Again, this is going to be familiar, again, looking back in hindsight. And the whole phrase planted like a willow twig, again, Zedekiah is installed in his native Jerusalem. It's a good position, and he gets to play king, essentially, but he's a puppet. He's a low-spreading vine, in the words of the parable. He's never he doesn't spread his own influence outward. You know, he's a vassal. He's hemmed in. He's restricted on what he can actually do. He's ruling as you know, in a subservient position to Nebuchadnezzar, so he's not independent. And the vine, Zedekiah, the vine's branches turn toward the eagle, turn toward Nebuchadnezzar. It indicates that he's subservient to his Babylonian overlord. Verse 7, there was another great eagle with great wings and much plumage. And behold, this vine, okay, the vine, again, we're talking about Zedekiah, this vine bent its roots toward him and shot forth its branches toward him from the bed where it was planted, that he might water it. It had been planted on good soil by abundant waters, that it might produce branches and bear fruit and become a noble vine. Say, this is verse 9, thus says the Lord God, will it thrive? Will he not pull up its roots? This is really a reference to the first eagle, and cut off its fruit so that it withers, so that all its fresh sprouting leaves wither. It will not take a strong arm or many people to pull it up from its roots. Behold, it is planted. Will it thrive? Will it not utterly wither when the east wind strikes it, wither away on the bed where it sprouted? That's the end of verse 10. So the second eagle, you know, this little section, verses 7 to 10, are about the second eagle and the vine. The vine is Zedekiah, and the puppet ruler. The second eagle is great, but not impressive as the first. In other words, that's evident from what we read here, because the second eagle doesn't really do anything. He's just simply there, and he attracts the attention of the vine, who turns his branches toward him, hoping that, oh, you know, you'll give me something. You'll water me, you know, and you'll help me flourish, and blah, 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 blah. And again, the parable's like, well, Nebuchadnezzar put you here, and you would have flourished if you'd have just listened to him. If you would have followed orders, you would have been okay. You'd be under no threat. But now that this second eagle has drawn your attention and you're looking to get something from him, namely, in the historical referent is getting help from Egypt against Nebuchadnezzar. You know, since when Nebuchadnezzar learns of this, then the first eagle learns of this, you're going to get plucked up. You're going to get destroyed. This is not going to work. So most scholars, again, think that this is an allegorical description of how Zedekiah, the vine, turned toward Egypt, looking for assistance against Babylon. And again, that's what we read in the account in the books of the Kings. Right? The second eagle is powerful, but he ain't Nebuchadnezzar. And so this is a failed tactic. This is something that's not going to produce any good result. Now, the validation of this interpretation is really given in verses 11 to 18. So we read through verse 10. Let's jump into verse 11. Then the word of the Lord came to me, say now to the rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and took her king and her princes and brought them to himself to Babylon. And he took one of the royal offspring and made a covenant with him, putting him under oath, the chief men of the land he had taken away, that the kingdom might be humble and not lift itself up and keep his covenant that it might stand. But he rebelled against him. Okay, this appointed king rebelled against the king of Babylon by sending his ambassadors to Egypt that they might give him horses and a large army. Will he thrive? Can one escape who does such things? Can he break the covenant and yet escape? As I live, declares the Lord God, surely in the place where the king dwells, who made him king, whose oath he despised, and whose covenant with him he broke, in Babylon he shall die. Pharaoh, with his mighty army and great company, will not help him in war, when mounds are cast up and siege walls built to cut off many lives. He despised the oath in breaking the covenant, and behold, he gave his hand and did all these things. He shall not escape. That's the end of verse 18. Now, the covenant here is this treaty arrangement, this treaty agreement that Zedekiah had made with Babylon. This is not a reference to a biblical covenant, you know, God's covenant or anything like that. In the context, again, it's an agreement that this, you know, Zedekiah had made with Nebuchadnezzar and vice versa, that, look, I'm going to install you here. I'm taking your king. I'm taking the rest of the important people back with me to the land, to Babylon. And, of course, Ezekiel was part of that, part of the second wave of the captivity. And I'm going to leave you here, Zedekiah, and you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine as long as you obey me. Again, this is a vassal status. This is a vassal agreement. Zedekiah is not going to be independent. And if you put up with that, if you abide by our agreement, you're going to be okay. And it's a good job. It's a good gig. But that isn't what Zedekiah does. Zedekiah, again, begins to solicit Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar is going to find out about it. And that's going to be it. They're going to be history. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come back and finish the job. He's going to destroy the city and destroy the temple in the last wave of the captivity. So basically, what the parable really means to teach us is that Zedekiah is a fool. You know, he tries to avoid, you know, what's going to happen here. Now, it's kind of interesting, if we read in verses 19 through 21, there's a little bit more of a detail here about how God looks at Zedekiah. So let's read that. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, as I live, surely it is my oath that Zedekiah, that he despised, and my covenant that he broke. I will return it upon his head. I will spread my net over him, and he shall be taken in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon and enter into judgment with him there for the treachery he has committed against me. And all the pick of his troops shall fall by the sword, and the survivors shall be scattered to every wind, and you shall know that I am the Lord. I have spoken. Now, these three verses transition to Ezekiel essentially, God through Ezekiel, essentially evaluating the theological implications of the riddle or the parable and Zedekiah's decisions. Now, Zedekiah's behavior in these three verses is treated as a rebellion against God. And you might ask, well, why? Well, because the context is clear about the agreement made with Nebuchadnezzar, and it all fits the historical series of events. We can go read in Kings and whatnot. Why does God look at Zedekiah's behavior here as some sort of personal offense? Well, 2 Chronicles 36:13 makes that apparent. We read there about Zedekiah. Let's just go back up to verse 11. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. Verse 13, here's the reference that we made. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by God. He stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel. Now, what you have going on here is that, you know, as part of Nebuchadnezzar, as part of keeping Zedekiah under control, or again, reaching this agreement, he made Zedekiah swear by the Lord that he would abide and he would be bound by this agreement. And so when Zedekiah starts soliciting Egypt to get out from under this agreement, again, to get rid of Babylon, God takes that as an offense because he had sworn by the Lord to do this particular thing, and now he's trying to get out of it. So that would be taking the Lord's name in vain, treating God's name with contempt. And that's why God is offended here. Block writes, as if legal authorization is required, this oath offered Yahweh as the grounds for, or offered Yahweh the grounds for intervening against the king because of his rebellion against the Babylonians. To violate a political covenant is to challenge the divine guarantor of the covenant. Again, unquote. Now, again, it was very common in the ancient Near East when people entered into agreements to make their god or their gods part of the agreements as witnesses. You know, there are a number of Psalm 89 is kind of a famous one with the Davidic covenant, where the witness to the covenant is the witness in the clouds, and it's singular. And again, those of you who remember the old myth draft, maybe, or my old newsletter from years and years ago, there's a very good case that can be made that the witness in the clouds that to the Davidic covenant, that's what Psalm 89 is about, is Yahweh himself, or again, this, you know, sort of, you know, a second Yahweh figure. In other words, it could actually be the Messiah himself or God himself. You know, their commentators disagree on that, and you can, you know, construct an argument either way. But you have this idea that God or the gods are brought into the agreement to be witnesses, and their witnessing of it, you know, just think of, you know, you have witnesses, you know, when you get married. They're supposed to hold you accountable to the decision you make. You have asked them to be witnesses to this thing, to your decision, and when you violate that, the witnesses are supposed to call you out. Well, that's what God's doing here. He's calling him out. And again, God is treating it as an offense that, you know, is my name so insignificant that you would use it frivolously to enter into this agreement? You know, you're just not going to get away with that, Zedekiah. I'm going to lower the boom on you, just like Nebuchadnezzar is going to. So Nebuchadnezzar again shows himself to be a fool by what he's doing here. Earlier, he was a political fool. Here, he's a spiritual fool. Okay, Zedekiah is just a fool in this whole chapter, Ezekiel 17. Now, the last few verses are the thing that I want to sort of drill down on for the rest of the episode. And again, I think you're going to find it interesting. It's probably a question that you've asked yourself at some point. But we read this. This is 22 through 24. Thus says the Lord God, I myself, you know, after all this, after Zedekiah is going to, you know, be dog meat here, God says, I myself will take a sprig from the lofty top of the cedar. Remember, the cedar was Jehoiakim, again, a member of the royal dynasty. I will take a sprig from the lofty top of the cedar, and I will set it out. I will break off from the topmost of its young twigs a tender one, and I myself will plant it, or him, you could translate it either way, on a high and lofty mountain. On the mountain height of Israel, I will plant it, or him, that it may bear branches and produce fruit and become a noble cedar. And under it will dwell every kind of bird. In the shade of its branches, birds of every sort will nest. And all the trees of the field shall know that I am the Lord. I bring low the high tree, and I make high the low tree. I dry up the green tree and make the dry tree flourish. I am the Lord. I have spoken, and I will do it. Now, this isn't really about replanting the tree of life or something like that. It's not abstract in that direction. You know, the mountain height of Israel, it's so don't think directly of the tree of life and of Eden. I mean, you'll see some commentators go that direction. Rather, it's describing a replanting of the Davidic line in or on Mount Zion. And that little sprig, maybe the term branch would be more familiar to you, that little sprig will grow into a great tree. And of course, under that tree, there will be all the birds of the sky, all the different, you know, of all different sorts, you know, will find refuge under this tree. Now, this imagery, again, you can already start to get the notion here because of the other planting imagery used in the prophets and other books about the Messiah. And of course, when you're talking about the Messiah and birds of all varieties taking refuge, you know, in and under this tree, It's a reference again to the Messiah asserting global sovereignty. Again, these are very familiar themes in biblical theology. And certainly, if you've read Unseen Realm, some of the previous podcasts, again, the whole reclaiming of the nations thing. This is another angle to it and another metaphor, another set of symbols for the symbolic language of it. Now, Block writes this. He says, the prophet highlights the special origin of the sprig. Not only is it of the topmost crown, it is also a special root. The Hebrew term here is rock, which gets translated tender one. The word seems to derive from rakak, to be tender or soft, but Ezekiel's usage is without parallel. Other prophets had employed a variety of horticultural expressions to designate the messianic scion who would revive the Davidic line, such as koter, that's usually translated shoot, and netzer, branch, in Isaiah 11:1. We have tzemach, sprout, in Jeremiah 23:5 and 33:15, also Zechariah 3:8, Zechariah 6:12. In this context, in Ezekiel's context, rock, shoot, again, this tender shoot, serves as a harbinger of the messianic figure who will be presented in greater detail in later salvation oracles. Ezekiel's image of a huge tree offering nourishment and protection for all creatures represents a Hebrew version of a widespread ancient mythological motif known as the cosmic tree. This tree, which is not to be associated with the tree of life in the paradise garden, again, directly. I'm going to add that caveat to what Block is saying. I think there's more to this than what Block is saying, but he's right. This isn't about the tree of life directly, but it is going to have something to do with that. Anyway, Block says, this tree, which is not to be associated with the tree of life in a paradise garden, is typically portrayed as a huge plant with its crown reaching into the heavens, top of the tree, and its roots going down to the subterranean streams from which it draws its nourishment, the waters, you know, under the earth. Although Ezekiel may have been introduced to the cosmic tree motif in Babylon, the present passage may also have been inspired by Isaiah 11:1 through 10, which conjoins the elements of a newly sprouted messianic shoot, the mountain of Yahweh, and peaceful coexistence with the wild animals. Again, these are all kingdom images. Block continues, whatever its antecedents, Ezekiel's tree bears its own stamp. This tree is planted on the high mountain of Israel, a clear allusion to Mount Zion. Although this mountain will become increasingly significant in later oracles, only here in Ezekiel are the motifs of Davidic line and Zion brought together. Both elements are truly remarkable, reminding the exiles that Yahweh had not forgotten his covenant with David, and the dynasty would survive the deportation. It would be revived within the context of its original founding, and its protective influence would be felt all around the world. That's the end of Block's quote. Now, I want to do a little bit of an excursus on this world tree thing, but here's the larger question. This is the question you may have asked yourself. Why do we get this branch language? Branch, shoot, root. You know, here we have tender ones, sprig, sprout. Why do we get this language for the Messiah in the Old Testament? Because you see it in a lot of places. Well, I think there are two trajectories to this, and one of them is more common in commentaries. You'll run into it, you know, more quickly in commentaries than the other one. And the other one, though, I think is much more interesting, and again, gets us into sort of Israelite, not only cosmological thinking, but also, again, some of the motifs associated with divine counsel, like the divine abode, the mountain, the cosmic garden, and all this sort of stuff. And Block has alluded to it. This cosmic tree idea is a very ancient Near Eastern Semitic thing. So that you have two trajectories. The cosmic tree thing is going to be the second, again, the one that's less commonly discussed in relation to this question. But the first one, the one that you'll probably run into in most, you know, ordinary commentaries, would say that the branch or sprig language is associated with God's choice and also with new life. And here's sort of the go-to passage for this idea. Numbers 17, 1 through 7. And in Hebrew, this is verses 16 through 23. There's a versification mismatch between Hebrew and English there. But Numbers 17, 1 through 7 says this, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and get from them staffs, one for each father's house. From all their chiefs according to their father's houses, 12 staffs. Write each man's name on his staff, and write Aaron's name on the staff of Levi. For there shall be one staff for the head of each father's house. Then you shall deposit them in the tent of meeting before the testimony, and before the ark, it's a reference to the ark, where I meet with you. And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. This is, again, God speaking. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you. Again, he's talking to Moses. So, verse 6, Moses spoke to the people of Israel, and all their chiefs gave him staffs, one for each chief according to their father's houses, 12 staff. And the staff of Aaron was among their staffs. And Moses deposited the staffs before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. Again, we know what happens. Aaron's rod buds, it sprouts. And so this denotes, again, God's choice of leadership. And also, again, you have dead staffs. And this whole idea of newness of life is going to become important when it is associated with Messiah. Because when Messiah comes, he's supposed to, again, bring the dead nation back to life. You know, again, this whole, you know, metaphorical set of ideas. So that's usually what you'll read in commentaries if you ask the question, well, what is all this horticultural language doing when it comes to Messiah? Commentators will typically take you back to this and say, oh, this is just, you know, one of the sort of familiar Old Testament signs for God's choosing, God's election, God's choice of leadership. Well, you know, I'm not going to say there's nothing to that, but I think the second one is a little more significant. And the second one, the second trajectory is this cosmic tree thing, but scholars typically talk about it in much bigger terms. And this is going to sound really strange, but the cosmic tree idea is part of what scholars refer to as the navel of the earth mythic thinking. This is what Block alluded to, but again, he doesn't connect the cosmic tree to the bigger picture. This is also referred to as the axis mundi, again, the world axis. Okay, that there's this idea. Think of Israelite cosmology. You've got a round flat earth. Underneath the earth, you've got the waters that are under the earth. You've got the pillars and all this stuff. And above, you know, you've got the firmament, the solid dome and whatnot. Well, in their thinking, there was sort of a polar axis that ran up through the middle of the earth, the center of the earth, what the Old Testament and other texts refer to as the navel of the earth. And that's an important idea. This sort of perpendicular pole, this magical or not magical, but this invisible pole, this idea, you know, ran from the bottom to the top, okay, underneath through the earth and then up to the top of the dome. And this thinking was that all of this is a metaphor for the fact that heaven and earth were connected, okay? Heaven and earth were connected. So if we can think on these terms, we're not so much, you know, really fixated on, you know, sort of the image, but what the image was meant to convey. And so where heaven and earth were connected was by this, again, this idea of a cosmic tree. Now, that does take us back to Eden, the tree of life, because the tree of life is in the presence of God. God is there on earth. Heaven has met earth. Heaven has come to earth. This is, you know, where God lives, all this sort of stuff. This is the source of life. Again, think about the word navel, okay? Well, you know, apply that to childbirth and what that's the point at which the child is connected to the mother. The mother, again, you know, gives it life, sustains it, so on and so forth. These are, again, big metaphorical ideas that are applied to just, again, the way the world is in the context of Israelite cosmology. So heaven and earth are connected, and the point at which they are connected, again, this imaginary, you know, world tree kind of thing runs through the center of the earth, runs through the center all the way up and all the way down. Now, in Greek thinking, this is called the term for navel. Is omphalos or omphalos. It's O-M-P-H-A-L-O-S. And you probably have seen that before if you're into sort of ancient religion and ancient mythology. I'll read a little bit from an article from LBD, the Lexham Bible Dictionary that we created at Logos. This is a free resource, by the way, that you can, you know, get for nothing, obviously, if it's free. You can search for it on the web and you can get it. But here's the entry on Navel of the Earth. It reads, part of it reads as follows. The myth of the navel of the world was common in many ancient cultures. The myth is often known as the Omphalos myth, from the Greek word for navel, omphalos or omphalos. The Omphalos myth often held that a sacred mountain was located at the center of the earth where the national deity dwelt and could be communicated with. So why a mountain? Well, a mountain appears to go up to the top of the sky. And of course, mountains, you know, they're sitting on the ground. But the idea was that, well, if we can penetrate the mountain, maybe through caves or something, you can actually go down as well. And so this mountain is just sort of this stone pillar. Again, try to work with the imagery here. This stone pillar that reached down to the recesses of the earth and all the way to the top of the earth. So for many, this image, this polar symbolism, if we can call it that, was pictured with a great mountain. Others had this great tree idea. Different cultures expressed it in different ways, but the whole point was that heaven and earth were connected and also under the earth. Now, continuing with the entry, the rest of creation was oriented around this location. So wherever this sacred mountain or sacred tree was, that was sort of where all the action is. That's where the deity or the gods, you know, really run things from. Everything else is oriented around them and around this location. Wensink, which is an important source on this, and by the way, you can get this source for free. We have this linked at the episode page for this episode. This is a public domain source, one of the few scholarly works on, the world tree idea, the navel of the earth idea. So you can get this source. But Wensink notes five general characteristics associated with this thinking. One, the location was exalted above the surrounding areas. Two, it was the place from which creation occurred. Three, it was the center of the earth. Four, it was the place of communication between heaven, earth, and the underworld. And five, it was the medium of distributing food over the earth. In other words, it's the thing that not only sort of created life from which, you know, creation sprang, but it's the thing that sustained all life. And it connected all aspects of you know, the perceived cosmology. We can see, how Eden would fit into this. And Eden is called, you know, the cosmic mountain. It's called a mountain. So it's part of... It's a biblical sort of illustration for, again, this thinking about this particular place where God lives and heaven meets earth, and this is the source of life. Again, all of this makes sense when you start to think about it in these very big, you know, picture kind of terms. Now, in the Bible, we'll go back to our LBD article. The author is David Phillips. He writes, "The Septuagint translators chose to translate the Hebrew word center, which is tabor, with the Greek word for navel, omphalos. Now, this word occurs in Judges 9:37 and Ezekiel 38:12, and it's the latter reference that I think is more interesting for our purposes, but I'll keep reading here. Based on this and usage of the term in other Jewish writings, Levinson argues that no other understanding of the word has been passed down. Childs, Reverend Childs, notes that other passages in the Bible speak to the concept of the navel of the earth, with their themes of the exaltation of Jerusalem. As you can imagine, you know, in the early chapters of Genesis, this is Eden. Eden is the center of the earth. It's the source of life. It's where the deity, you know, lives. It's where everything happens. You know, it's what sustains everything else. Or at least that was the plan, obviously. But later, you're going to have this be Mount Zion, Jerusalem, okay? The entry continues, "Passages that could be understood as depicting Zion and Eden as the sacred mountain at the center of the earth include Genesis 2:10 through 14. Again, that's the familiar, you know, Edenic description. Ezekiel 28:13. Again, this is where Eden, again, is referred to as the garden of God, and of course, elsewhere in that chapter, it's going to be the mountain of God, and Zechariah 14:8. Now, this one's a little less familiar. "That day living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea. It shall continue as summer as it is in winter." This idea that Jerusalem is the source of, quote, living waters, and that's an important idea. Now, in addition to that, there are passages, for instance, in 1st Enoch that refer to Jerusalem as the center of the earth, 1st Enoch 26:1. From there I proceeded to the center of the earth, and I saw a blessed place where there were trees that had branches that abide and sprout. And there I saw a holy mountain. From beneath the mountain water came from the east, and it flowed toward the south. Again, consider the language there. Flowed from the east toward the south. Again, you know, you're going to have biblical precedence for that being described as Jerusalem. Jubilees 8, though, it gets a little more explicit. Noah rejoiced, because this portion was assigned to Shem and for his sons. This is the book of Jubilees talking about events after the flood. And he remembered everything which he spoke with his mouth concerning him. This is, again, Noah remembering, and he said, "May the Lord God of Shem be blessed. May the Lord dwell in the dwelling place of Shem." And he knew that the Garden of Eden was the Holy of Holies and the dwelling of the Lord. And Mount Sinai was in the midst of the desert, and Mount Zion was in the midst of the navel of the earth. Again, it's very explicit there. This idea that the dwelling place of God is the center of the earth. Now, here's the point for our purposes here. Jerusalem is viewed in biblical thinking as the center of the earth, the navel of the earth. Jerusalem, or Zion, is described as a cosmic mountain in the Hebrew Bible. You know, we get that. There's a reference in Psalm 48, 1-2. Mount Zion, again, is you know, the holy mountain. In the far reaches of the north, again, if you remember from Unseen Realm, the uttermost north, Tsafon, this was the mountain of Baal, because that's the mountain that lots of Israelites and Canaanites thought that Baal lived and ran everything, ran the show from. This is where Baal and his council met and lived. And the psalmist is saying, look, that isn't true. You know, the heights of the north, the real sovereign here is the God of Israel, and he rules from Zion. Again, so taking that language, Isaiah 2, Micah 4, 1 through 3, again, referring to Jerusalem and Zion as, you know, the mountain of the Lord. Again, this is pretty familiar. If you look at Ezekiel 5, 5, though, it says, "Thus says the Lord God, this is Jerusalem. I have set her in the center of the nations, with countries all around her." And again, going back to where we sort of started this, this whole idea of Tabor being the navel of the earth, in Ezekiel 38, 12, we read this. This is the part of the Gog and Magog passage. Look at how the place they're invading, which of course we know from, if we read all of chapters 38 and 39, is going to be Jerusalem. We read, "The Gog is coming to seize spoil and carry off plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places that are now inhabited, and the people who were gathered from the nations, who have acquired livestock and goods, who dwell at the center of the earth." And the word there is Tabor. So there's this notion that Jerusalem, Zion, is the center of the world. Again, and that has very cosmic theological significance. It's also described as a well-watered garden, just like Eden, Isaiah 33, 20 through 22. And these cross-references are in Unseen Realm, but we don't often think of Zion being described as a well-watered garden, just like Eden. Again, this place that, you know, marks, you know, the center of everything, the center of the world. "Behold Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, an untroubled habitation, an immovable tent whose stakes will never be plucked up, nor will any of its cords be broken. Okay. But there the Lord in majesty will be for us a place of broad rivers and streams." You know, Zion, a broad place of broad rivers and streams, where no galley with oars can go and no majestic ship can pass. Well, again, it's applying this cosmic waters idea to Jerusalem. Ezekiel 47:12. This is going to be part of the whole temple vision in chapters 40 through 48 when we get there. You have water flowing from the temple. Verse, you know, this is chapter 47, start at the beginning. "Then he brought me back from the door of the temple," or to the door of the temple, "and behold, water was issuing from below the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the temple faced east, and water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. He brought me up by way of the north gate, led me around on the outside of the outer gate that faces toward the east, and behold, the water was trickling out on the south side." Again, this place of, of flowing waters, flowing rivers, you know, Zion. We read Zechariah 14:8, so we'll go to Joel 3:8, another one of these references. In that day, the mountains shall drip wine, and the hills shall flow with milk. And all the stream beds of Judah shall flow with water, and a fountain shall come forth from the house of the Lord, and water the valley of Shittim. Again, this isn't sort of like real, literal geography. This is cosmic geography, not in the sense of, you know, the nations around Israel being controlled by other gods, but this is a part of cosmic geography that we really haven't developed much in Unseen Realm. There's a smattering of this, a little bit in the chapters about Temple and Zion and Eden and all that sort of stuff. But here we need to be called back to remember it, because let's think about, you know, go back to the question we asked. Why do we have this horticultural imagery of the sprout, the sprig, the shoot, the branch, all this stuff about the Messiah? Well, it's because the Messiah comes from the house of God. He comes from the place where God lives, you know, obviously because he is God, but he comes from the place where God exists. The place where God exists is a cosmic mountain. It's a cosmic garden and a cosmic tree. Again, this idea. So this is why Messiah is spoken of in tree language. Okay, in garden horticultural language, it's supposed to take your mind back to the cosmic tree, to the cosmic, you know, garden, to Eden. And Zion is just another Eden. That's what it was intended to be, and that's what it will be. Again, think of the end of the book of Revelation. Again, you have the heavenly Zion, you know, heavenly Jerusalem, you know, coming down, you know, to the earth. And again, we have a global Eden, and it's the center of the world. And so this is what the Israelites are thinking. And so when the writers use these terms, they were trying to deliberately conjure these images of the place where God lives, his house, where he's from. And think about what happens there. It's the source of life. It's the thing that sustains all life. The tree imagery here we get in Ezekiel 17 about, you know, God himself is going to pluck a branch. He's going to take, again, really, if I can, you know, abstract it this way, he's going to take something, you know, from the cosmic Garden of Eden, and specifically not just a thing, but this thing represents a person, an entity, someone. God's going to take him up, and that one is also not just going to be divine, because we're talking about God's house here. We're talking about Eden. We're talking about the cosmic garden, the cosmic mountain, the cosmic tree. But he's going to be from the line of David. He's human as well. And he's going to plant him in Zion someday. I mean, this is Ezekiel talking, so this is going to be really far in the future, because bad things are happening right now. But in the future, God is going to plant on Mount Zion, essentially this little sprig that's plucked from Eden, that's plucked from the very dwelling place of God. Again, this place where heaven meets earth. And it's going to grow, and it's going to grow into this great tree, and the tree is going to provide refuge and sustenance for the whole world. This is, again, a complex matrix of ideas that is largely lost on us, but it would have meant something for them. Again, the cosmic garden in there, there's the tree of life. It's the presence of God. That's a metaphor for the presence of God. Just like the menorah, you know, represented the tree of life and the tabernacle and the temple, again, where God was taking residence. Again, the branch and all this branch sprig language, these are extensions of the tree. These are extensions of the garden. And thus the cosmic garden, cosmic mountain, ultimately the life source, which is God, it's an extension of God himself. And connecting it to David's line, connecting that imagery to David's line, telegraphs a human extension from Eden, a human extension from God's family. It's messianic. It's very overtly messianic. And you know, we sort of can pick up on this, you know, from here and there in the different passages, but we lack, again, the cosmological worldview. We lack this matrix of ideas where when we come across passages that talk about the Messiah, like a root or a sprig or a branch or something, you know, you might wonder, well, what, you know, what possible significance is that? It's just something that grows in the ground. No, it's a whole lot more than that. It really meant a whole lot more in their cosmological outlook than that. And it actually, as strange as it sounds, using this language of a descendant from David would have indicated that there's something about this descendant of David that is divine. It's God plus the descendant of David. This figure is going to like be right out of Eden, but yet also a man. So it's very important language, again, for Old Testament to articulate Old Testament messianic thinking. And I think it's important, not just because it's kind of neat to be able to think like an Israelite, all right? But it's also neat to head off dumb statements that are often made by critics that the idea of Messiah was just purely earthly, purely human being. This idea of a divine Messiah was something they made up after the fact. That's just nonsense. That just tells me, and it ought to tell you now, that whoever's making that statement doesn't have any idea of how an ancient Israelite would have thought in their own context when they're thinking about the Messiah. So for that alone, I think it's an important thing to sort of camp on. We spent a lot of time on that. But it's a good teaching point, good content point, and frankly, a good apologetic point that the New Testament, what it says about Jesus, and this again, this matrix of ideas about Jesus and Christology, has deep, deep Old Testament, ancient Near Eastern roots, and is not just a contrived invention.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's one of the that was better than what I thought it would be. That's interesting. Where you went with that?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that's not self-evident, but
right.
When you see it, you won't really be able to unsee it because it'll, oh, okay, I get it. You know, I know how they were thinking.
All right, Mike, next week we're going to have a special guest with us.
Yeah, we're going to have Johnny Cisneros as a guest on the podcast. Johnny is a longtime friend of mine. For many years had been a colleague of mine at Logos Bible Software. Johnny, and myself, we were the ones who created Learn to Use Greek and Hebrew. So we've had many discussions over the years about how to get tools into people's hands that are beneficial, that are useful, again, to move people beyond just being Bible readers, again, to Bible students. And one of the things, sort of the entry point for doing that, and a lot of our audience is going to be familiar with this, is word studies. You know, people are used to using Strong's numbers. You know, I know Chuck Missler put out some stuff about, you know, doing word studies and whatnot. We're going to talk about that, about biblical word study, and very specifically something that Johnny and I have created, a tool, really a course, for helping people become proficient in word studies. Not, and again, it doesn't require that you buy software. It doesn't require that you buy anything. We're going to show you through this course that we're going to talk about next time, and we'll talk about again just the philosophy of what we're trying to accomplish here. You're going to be able to do what we show you if you have software and if you don't, with free resources too. So this is an effort that we're making to create something that people can get that will take them, you know, to the next level in their Bible study, and also really understand why they would do certain things and what the interpretive payoff should be when you're trying to do certain things in your Bible study.
I'm excited about that and how I can incorporate some of these other tools you're going to be talking about and even what y'all have created. So that's going to be interesting to hear about.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good episode and a good chat with him.
All right. Well, that sounds good. Well, again, I just want to ask everybody, if you haven't already, please go rate and leave us a review if you will, anywhere where you consume our podcast. And please go subscribe to the newsletter at drmsh.com if you have not done so already. And with that, Mike, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast.
To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.